Herbert, 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 Herbert.
What does Herbert mean?
It is somewhat uncomplimentary, Captain.
Stallions, the official podcast of the website Plaid Stallions. I'm Brian, and with me, many, many miles away, is my pal Jason.
Hello, everybody.
And today, I think it's very topical and important that we revisit the Star Trek universe. And this is mostly because of the, I'd say, huge passing of an icon of our lives, Leonard Nimoy. Mr. Nimoy passed away this month, and it was a huge shock to, I think, his fans and the world in general. We thought he'd live forever.
That's just it. You know, we knew he was 83, and we knew that he had been diagnosed with this pulmonary disease for a long time. He was sick for a very long time.
Yeah, that when I think a photo of him in the airport with an oxygen tank.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, oh, no. Yeah, I had no idea he was a smoker, still a smoker for that long.
And that was, you know, that shot was, you know, like 5 years ago.
Was it really?
Yeah, that was like 4 years ago or something. So he lived, he was sick for a long time and still, you know, made it to conventions and still made appearances and, you know, showed up in certain shows and, you know, did some voiceover here and there and stuff. Yeah, it really kind of knocked me out in a way that I guess I didn't quite expect it to.
Celebrity deaths are they don't usually impact you that much. Like, you know, you can feel bad, you can say, "Oh no." But when I saw that, you know, that RIP and it was a picture of Spock, I actually gasped.
Yeah,
because it was like somebody I knew died, and I guess in a way that's really what happened, because he's always been around. He's so iconic, and the other thing I think about Nimoy is that he's had nothing but good PR all his life.
Right.
He's parodied himself on The Simpsons. He's iconic, but he's never seemed to take himself too terribly seriously.
Right.
And it's always just kind of worked. So you liked him. Yeah, I've never met him. I never wanted to meet him. Because I how horrible would it be, you catch Spock on a bad day.
Right.
And then every time you see Spock, you can't handle it.
Yeah, I think he, you know, like most performers, actors that get saddled with a role, he had huge conflicts with it, which was, you know, you work all your life to get a regular role on a show so you can continue to work. And then every now and then a show comes along and has a character that's larger than the show. It's larger than you. How do you deal with that? How do you, you know, not only walk the line of fandom and just realize how big this character is to the world and how much is wanted from you as this character? But then start to think, can I do character stuff anymore? Can I pop over here and do this? And, you know, I think he had an easier time, oddly enough, getting, you know, work for himself after Star Trek. I think he had an easier time than Shatner did. I'm not sure why, but he was a regular on Mission Impossible.
Yeah, he became Paris, right?
Yeah, no, and he, which is ironic because he replaced Martin Landau's character.
That's right.
And Martin Landau could have been Spock. It would have been a different world if it had been Martin Landau, I'll tell you that.
It certainly would have, yeah.
And, he, You know, he did In Search Of, which was...
I remember he did a TV movie called Baffled.
Baffled?
Yeah, now I can't... Now, I'm sorry to have stuck a stick in your spokes while you were talking. I just came out of nowhere.
Did he do the one... Or what? This was Shatner, called Pray for the Wildcats?
I don't know that one.
You don't know that one?
No.
Oh, man.
Shatner had it pretty sweet, by the way, though. He was doing those Miracle Mart commercials.
It was Shatner and Marjo Gortner.
Oh.
And I want to say George Kennedy or someone like that. I'm like, that was your... No. You know who was the big heavy? The big heavy in the piece was Andy Griffith. It was a mid-70s thing. These middle-aged, you know, businessmen, when they go up to this mountain where they go every year to ride dirt bikes, and Griffith is kind of being out of line and grabbing ladies and stuff and having a nervous breakdown, you know, midlife crisis. And, of course, the big biker gang that's up there don't take too kindly to it. But I think it's called Pray for the Wildcats.
Oh, my God. I've read about that.
It's what a cast. I mean, Shatner, Marjo Gortner... Andy Griffith as the bad guy. I think George Kennedy or somebody. You got to see it just to see that.
Yeah, okay. I now want to see that.
Now you have to, but I don't think Nimoy's in that. So,
but Nimoy got into movies like Invasion, The Body Snatchers.
Yeah, so like I said, we're going along. We're being kids. We're watching TV. We got Star Trek and reruns. We know those are not new shows. We know they're old shows. Looking for new Star Trek stuff. Ooh, here come the cartoons. We watched the cartoons, knowing that was newer stuff and hearing voices that were newer. So we thought, ooh, they're working together again. Isn't this cool? This is like a continuation of the shows that we watched, you know, later in the day. Here we've got another set of stories for Star Trek. And, you know, eventually it became, is it going to be, you know, a movie? Like I don't remember ever really hearing about the TV series aspect, you know, if that was going to happen.
Well, that was in Starlog a lot.
But Starlog did talk about it, yeah. They talked about it a lot. And every time Nimoy would do something, you're right, it would be there in Starlog. Like, the cover was, you know, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. His part is prominently featured in the magazine.
Yeah.
That interview and so on.
Even when I think he did a movie about Golda Meir, it was featured in Starlog.
Yeah, that was one of his caveats. You know, it had to be in Starlog.
Well, I think he was front page news. He was a Kardashian for the Starlog group, you know.
He was a Kardashian for the Golda Meir family, I'll tell you that.
For sure. I've never seen that. Actually, I did see that film.
But then the big thing was Body Snatchers.
Yeah.
That was a big movie that he would have been in prior to... the motion picture. And that was a big movie. Big remake. Great remake by a guy called Philip Kaufman, who's a great filmmaker. Who Philip Kaufman, the name will come to you, you'll most recognize it probably, as one of the story contributors to the script of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh, no kidding.
And he also did The Right Stuff, the movie about the, you know, all the astronauts.
Yeah, I remember it.
Yeah. But Philip Kaufman came up with the Ark of the Covenant. That was his MacGuffin to add to the story for Raiders of the Lost Ark. That came from Philip Kaufman. So he did this great version of Body Snatchers. I think there's been 3 to 4... versions of the Body Snatchers that have been made so far. The one from the 50s is hugely effective for what it is.
And that is it's a thing. It's about communism, really.
Yes, it's completely about McCarthyism.
McCarthyism, my God.
You know, don't let them start pointing the finger at you. They'll start pointing the finger. People are going to be paying attention. Next thing you know, you turn around and you're one of them too. And, you know, we got to get you in conforming. And it's about conforming. And... The genius of it is, don't fall asleep. You know, mm-hmm. if you start to fall asleep, that's when your guard is down. When you're at your weakest, that's the time they get you, when you're susceptible.
Now, Kaufman changed the allegory of his, and I can't quite remember. Like, it's been a long time, but I remember thinking it was brilliant. It was obviously not a McCarthyism allegory anymore.
What it was the, you know, late 70s, if you want to call it San Francisco or just California vibe of self-help and Leo Biscaglia and...
Right.
You know, finding your inner, you know, because it's because of mom that I never became an astronaut and dad held me back and, you know, get it out, scream about it and take a mud bath and, you know, then it all gets beautiful, you know, and it really took the piss out of all that stuff. These, you know, EST and, you know, self-help, you know, seminars and things like that. It was a perfect place to put it. I think the initial film was it in a small town, and then this was in San Francisco, and then there was another remake that Abel Ferrara did.
I saw that in the theater.
In the early 90s.
Yeah, it was just called Body Snatchers. It's set on an army base.
On an army base. So it gets closer to, like, Washington, D.C., which is interesting.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that film, actually.
But there's some really good stuff in that film, and Nimoy's great in it. Of course, we were watching him on In Search Of... all the time. And
In Search Of was really huge in my house.
Yeah, ours too.
Yeah, scary. And it really entered into the pop culture kind of zeitgeist. I mean, it was parodied on Saturday Night Live, I think, at one point.
Yeah. It was great. And but it was probably the last thing I saw him in before Star Trek. And it would. I think I told you this before. It would kind of make me slightly melancholy, kind of sad. Because I would see him on that show and think, that's it. You know, he's familiar. I just saw him over here playing Spock. And gosh, that was already 8 years ago.
Yeah.
I sure would like to see him play Spock, but he's never going to play Spock again. Clearly, because now he's hosting this show and he has moved on and it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. And right around that time, you know, 78, 77... 76, Paramount's been talking about putting together a, you know, new, what you call, new network. That didn't happen. It became Star Trek the Motion Picture, which was big, which we talked about, big enough that they do a sequel called Wrath of Khan, which was even bigger and, of course, made Spock even more mythical because he kicked the bucket in Wrath of Khan. Did you come out of Wrath of Khan thinking that was it? He is going to be gone for good? I guess let me rephrase it. I guess the title was a dead giveaway, you know, The Search for Spock. But
oh, yeah.
Did you think we were actually going to get him back?
Yeah, because there was two – maybe it's because it was one of the first movies I ever rented with a VCR. And, you know, remember you'd rent a movie with a VCR and you'd watch it like – Saturday morning till Sunday night when you returned it. I did that with the Star Trek movies. And Wrath of Khan has two very big, obvious cheats to the sequel, which is one, he grabs Dr. McCoy's head and says, remember. And then two, there's that open casket scene at the end of Wrath of Khan.
Right.
So you knew that this door was being left open. Yeah, the title of Search for Spock was pretty easy. I think Wrath of Khan came out, I think, a year later?
Wrath of Khan was 82.
Okay, you know what? I'm thinking video. You're right. And Search for Spock was 84.
Spock was 84.
Yeah, I saw Spock. I didn't get to see Search for Spock in the theater. I don't know what went out. I think I went to see The Last Dragon or something dumb like that instead.
By Barry Gordy?
Yes. Yes. Well, who could forget Shownuff? The Search for Spock was a big hit. It was, and Nimoy directed it.
That's right.
And I keep forgetting that, actually. You'd never think of that one as being one of his directorial. I think it's his first major motion picture.
He did that one. Then he did, with the success of that, he did Star Trek IV, which was huge.
Oh, yeah. We can get into that.
And then he went on from there. But
did you see Star Trek III in the theater?
I saw all of them in the theater, every one.
Okay, all right. Were you a fan of this film?
I was.
Yeah?
I absolutely was, yeah. Because I knew that we were taking someplace dark. And, you know, people, there's that old thing that's been going on forever that, you know, the odd-numbered ones aren't as good. The even-numbered ones are good.
I don't think three works in that theory.
Well, three they don't consider, you know, a very good.
Really?
They think Khan is great. Three is eh, and then Star Trek six with the whales, or
Star Trek four with the
four
whales.
With the whales is fantastic. So, I would argue that I think three is great. There's very very emotional stuff going on at the beginning. With Kirk's loss, with Sarek coming to see him and doing the mind meld and realizing that he never joined up with Kirk, looking through the video, there's a bit of a mystery going on, and then McCoy's acting erratic. There's some funny stuff there. Just the idea that from beyond the grave.
Yeah, Spock's in McCoy's head.
Spock's in McCoy's head of all.
I actually find that film funny unintentionally for the. The crew's casual wear.
Yeah.
Some of their 23rd century leisure suits are kind of amusing for me.
Yeah, it gets real good when they're standing on the corner in San Francisco and McCoy looks like he's about 4 inches wide. He's so tiny.
Yeah.
And everyone's standing around in these Martha Graham Starfleet-made uniforms.
Yeah.
So there's some great stuff in there where, you know, the whole thing between Savick and David getting killed.
I hated that.
It's brutal.
Because they introduced the character in the second film. Absolutely nothing is done between Kirk and David in terms of a relationship, and then he's killed.
And he's instantly taken away because it's like,
yeah.
this is how serious this is. We're going to, if you don't give us a thing, we're going to kill. You know, these aren't like cartoon Klingons. This is...
Oh yeah,
do something really bad, and you know it would put, you know, whereas the second one pushes everyone to the edge of what they're capable of, and then takes Spock and pushes him even further, which is to sacrifice the one for the many,
yeah,
and be sick, and you know get the ship out of danger and make the sacrifice. Well, the next one he sacrifices his son, you know,
his career.
Unwittingly, his entire career. Mm-hmm.
His ship.
Ship gets destroyed. And that's a great bit when they're on the planet, on Vulcan, when he turns to McCoy and says, "Oh my God, McCoy, what have I done?" And McCoy says, "What you always do, take a fighting chance and turn it into a real way to survive."
Yeah.
You know,
I think it's a competent film. I liked it. I didn't get to see it in the theater because, again, you couldn't say Star Trek to my dad after seeing the first one. So the way I saw it was through the DC Comics adaptation, which was actually pretty good. And I had to wait until I think a friend rented it on video. I'll never forget this. He invited me over for the weekend. And he rented two movies, War Games and Star Trek III, which we watched about four times each.
Nice.
Yeah, well, you know, before trading games on Commodore 64. Real ladies' men.
Nice.
I've always been fond of the film. Not overly fond of it, but it's not bad. I think it's one of the first debuts of Christopher Lloyd as a bad guy. I don't think, you know, I think he was mostly known to the world as Jim Ignatowski before that, and this was his, like, feature film, if I'm not mistaken, unless he was was he in Legend of the Lone Ranger?
Yes, he actually was a bad guy in Legend of the Lone Ranger.
Okay, so I'm a little off.
But it is, you know, it is funny because it took a long time for me to sort of give over to...
Oh, yeah, he's Butch Cavendish.
for me to give over to his Jim Ignatowski, you know, because he's doing a bit of Jim with Krug, you know.
Oh, for sure.
He's,
yeah.
tell me when the when are the missiles gonna be ready?
You know, he's still kind of doing some of that.
There's a little wide-eyed thing. Yeah, I can see that. But the only other time I'd seen him as a villain was the pilot to Street Hawk before that.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
you got me there.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember thinking, hey, that's Jim Ignatowski. So, I thought he did a pretty good job of it.
Well, I always go back to it too because it was the summer of 84. I've talked about this before. Intergalactic Trading Company had their summer of 84, summer winter 84. 84 was going to be the year for genre motion pictures. Let's take a look. What do we have here? They had the Temple of Doom LJN line of figures with Willie and Short Round pictured, even though those never got made.
Those are the Battle-Matic action ones, right?
Battle-Matic action ones. They had those pictured. They had the Star Trek III Ertl action figures and set of die-cast ships. They had the Dune action figures, vehicles, and weapons all in this same catalog. And they had, what was the other big one? They had some Ghostbuster stuff in there. And there was another big Gremlins. They had all the Gremlins, like vinyl figures and dolls and stuff, were in this catalog. Everything that was going to be 84 was there. And I obsessed over getting those four Star Trek III action figures because we, up until this point, we had had our Mego stuff for the TV show. The movies come out. Mego did 3¾-inch of the entire crew and 12-inch figures of quite a few characters. But then when Wrath of Khan came along and I knew that this was going to be the new standard uniform and Star Trek III came along, we hadn't really gotten like a bendy, you know, ultra-posable G.I. Joe style action figure from Star Trek yet.
Yeah, I bought those figures. I remember buying them at a grocery store. They were found easier at grocery stores than toy stores for me. And one thing I noticed is that I saw them broken in the package when they came out, because I guess the O-ring snapped.
Oh yeah.
And the other thing I remember about them is that their phasers were massive.
Massive.
You could actually put them in Amigo's hands.
Yes, you could.
It was weird scaling. It kind of felt like they got that figure license because nobody cared.
Probably. Yeah, probably. Because I'll tell you what, they took the same Bird of Prey and the same Enterprise and Ertl repackaged them for Star Trek V.
Oh, yeah.
And stuck them out, put them out for V. Although, go back a bit, didn't Corgi do a set of ships for Star Trek II?
Yes, they did. Just put the Revenge of Khan. Was that it?
Or I think it said the Vengeance of Khan.
Vengeance of Khan. Yeah, I bought packaging. Those.
And then the wings themselves, I thought had the number 2 on them, or ST2 or something.
Yeah, it was the movie Enterprise.
Yes.
I was still young enough. I bought one of those. I played with it. I mean, I think that came out when I was like 11. So, but I would love to have that back, actually. The other thing I wanted to talk about with Wrath of Khan Star Trek III is Krug has one of the great fakey movie falls of the 80s when Kirk kicks him into that volcano.
He does?
Yeah, you know, it's not as bad as Dick Jones from RoboCop.
Yeah, that's a bad one.
That one's really bad. But it is one of those goofy, we haven't figured this technology out yet. Go back and look at that.
I just remember him kicking him in the face and saying, I have had enough of you.
Yeah. And which seems a little lighthearted for the guy who just killed his son.
Just knifed your son.
Yeah.
And basically, you know, helped kill your Vulcan.
I swore more when I fell down. Putting out my recycling this morning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a little too. Well, but also, you know, I always had a hard time with just how, but I guess it has to happen in movies, you know, how quickly
they sort of picked up and brushed themselves off and moved along in Wrath of Khan.
Now, which Savick do you like? Do you like...
Kirstie Alley.
Kirstie Alley wins for me, too. What's her name? Robin...
Robin Curtis.
Robin Curtis. Yeah, and they never did much with the character after 3.
Nope.
I don't even think she's in... She has a brief cameo in 4, and I don't think they use Savick again, do they?
No, she has a brief cameo in 4 at the top of the mountain or something, or saying goodbye. She's been hanging out on Vulcan or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it, you know?
So... Spock's alive. The film's a big hit. So you know they're going to come back. And it takes a while for the Trek the Trek films to come around again. But in the meantime, I started going to conventions and stuff around the middle 80s. I started dealing toys. So Star Trek conventions were one of the few places you could deal old toys.
No.
And they were really, in my neck of the woods, they were really kind of like in high school gyms and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
At the time.
Yeah.
They weren't big affairs. They were rarely in hotels. If they were in a hotel, they had comics or something involved, because comics were bigger than Star Trek, I think, at least in my neck of the woods. But I noticed something. The Next Generation debuted, what, around 1987?
87, yeah.
Yeah, just around the same time that Star Trek IV comes out. 4 is a huge hit. I went to one of the first Star Trek conventions around here that happened after Next Generation debuted. And the people there hated it. And, you know, they didn't like the characters, they didn't like the show, they were complaining, because I was just listening to people all day. And then, flash forward a year and a half later, the conventions were twice the size.
Yeah.
And it was filled with people I hadn't seen before.
Yeah.
That show really, with, you know, it was like the 1-2 punch of Star Trek IV coming out, and it's a movie your parents went to. And then the Next Generation, it seemed to elevate Star Trek's profile in the landscape.
Yeah.
Phenomenon.
I had only gone to, like I said, never went to any conventions in the Twin Cities, never knew of any really growing up. It wasn't until I got older that I started to notice, you know, the ads in Starlog or whatever. But went to a convention in Philadelphia at this armory or something that certain listeners, I think, know what I'm talking about. The very weekend that Mary Tam was there and Kirk's son was there as well.
Merrick Buttrick.
And it just kind of blew my mind, because I'd never seen anything like this. And walking into that dealer room just really did my head in, because I was looking at stuff I'd only seen in magazines, you know, for Doctor Who and these British boys.
Do you remember how dealer rooms, like, you go into shows now and it's so much different. Dealer rooms back then, they were smaller, but they were also full of, like, people you don't see anymore at shows, like the guy with slides. Or the guy, you know, the guy with just postcards, or the woman who knits Tom Baker scarves and buttons. What happened to buttons?
Buttons, like homemade buttons with faces on them and stuff.
Yeah, all that stuff is gone.
Yeah. Or, you know, there used to be a big deal on, you know, like stickers and bumper stickers.
Oh yeah.
And badges that had phrases on them and stuff.
Oh yeah, TK Graphics. Didn't we talk about?
Yeah,
this?
My other car is a unicorn, or, you know,
yeah,
some shit like that, where the buttons, you know, the badges had, you know, nothing licensed on it, but it was a reference to a Doctor Who thing or a Star Trek thing or something. And
okay, I'm gonna out myself here, but I sent it to you. But I was at my parents' place, and I found that button that has a drawing of a lump of seaweed, and it says, "Would you take orders from a lump of seaweed?" And the seaweed saying, "Praise the company." And it could be the nerdiest thing I owned in my life. I cannot believe I bought it. It is a reference to one episode of Doctor Who called The Sunmakers, an episode I don't even like. And I owned a button of it that I must have worn on a lapel at some time. And it's just like, it blows my mind. You know,
it's like a hand-drawn thing.
Yeah, and it's this is the kind of stuff you found at conventions. Now you go in and, you know, you just see walls of new merchandise, all licensed. It's just a different place.
Right.
You know, and I bet you that dealer's room of that first con, which blew your mind, would suck to you now if you walked in there.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
It probably was quaint.
Yeah.
But it was like nothing I'd ever seen before. The merchandise, everything. It was bizarre. And that was all for that year of 84 where like the Doctor Who Romana episodes were running and Star Trek 3 was a big movie and everything. And I don't think I went to a convention in the Twin Cities regarding Star Trek until Undiscovered Country in 91 where they opened the movie on a Friday and the convention was going to open on Friday. But if you got your tickets, then you'd go to the show on Saturday and by like 11 a.m. Saturday morning, Shatner and Nimoy, first time on stage together in like 10 years or something, came out of the time travel, you know, vortex or whatever from City on the Edge of Forever. And they came out toward the audience and, you know, riffed on the audience for a couple hours and then started taking questions.
Really?
And I was lucky enough to go to that one. That was 1990. That had to be 91, the Saturday morning after seeing Star Trek VI the night before.
Really? That's amazing. Did you go to that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It was downtown Minneapolis. Went with a buddy of mine, and it was crazy. It was just a big, giant... Now it started to feel like a real sci-fi convention, you know? All Star Trek. But it was a big deal because that was the big farewell movie, you know?
And around that time, I think the late 80s too, the series got released on video. It had been fooled around with before.
Right.
Remember those cassettes you could buy with two episodes?
Or yep.
The video discs with two... I love the art on those. And then... But finally, you could... I remember this because I knew a video dealer. I was doing Star Trek conventions with toys and VHS and all that stuff.
Right.
And there was a video dealer across from me. And what he would do is he had the entire set of Star Trek. And people would come in and go, oh, I want to buy that. And he'd charge them like probably like $350. But he would have to give them like boxes of tapes.
Uh-huh.
What was there, 72 episodes? So he'd be like, here you go. And it'd be this huge. And if you've ever moved as a geek, you know how heavy VHS are.
Yeah.
It was just, I remember that. I remember, like, now that's insane because you could hand somebody something that's the size of your phone. And it would have every episode
right.
on it. But back then, you know, that was the thing, that was the deal.
Yep.
And absolutely, really a renaissance period. But for The Voyage Home, again, big movie. Star Trek III was a big movie. No merchandise to speak of for Star Trek.
Nothing. We're going to rectify that with some stuff that we're doing for our categories, mm-hmm. Biff Bang Pow. We're actually going to launch with a couple of things specifically tied into Voyage Home. But there was nothing. There was nothing. I'm not sure there were even like model kits or anything. There was nothing really tied into that movie, really merchandise-wise, considering how huge it was. It was the biggest of all the Star Trek films at that point. I think it was the biggest, wasn't it?
I think it was. And, you know, I'm not terribly fond of it. It's too much of a departure for me. It's fun. And I get it. These characters were such big icons that they did a bit of a romp with them, and it worked.
Right.
But it's kind of like a carry-on film in a way at times because you know it's these let's see what hijinks the Enterprise can get to in the 80s. But it's not my favorite of the Star Trek films.
I would go with two and six would be my favorites.
Those are very good choices. I'd probably agree with you.
Yeah. And then we get to five that has been the most berated and made fun of, and Shatner's ego and the mess of an ending and the low...
How do you take the fact that he wanted to direct the fifth one? Like, do you think that was sort of like, move over, I want to do this?
Yes. Or,
yeah?
I think it absolutely was. Well, how come he gets to?
Yeah.
You know, because remember, he was the star of the show.
Yeah.
He was.
But I mean, I've always thought that Nimoy was, him and Nimoy were always totally copacetic too.
So. They became more copacetic. They became more copacetic in the 80s doing those movies than they were, you know, back in the 70s, you know, bumping into each other at conventions and stuff. So I think he finally just said to the studio, come on, you know, it looks ridiculous. You're giving this guy a chance and not the lead actor. Mm-hmm. I should have a go at directing, you know. Either pure ego. I'm sure it's pure ego. And a bit of marketing, too, I'm sure, on their part. But I don't think anybody thought, well, Shatner can't do any worse than Nimoy. Like, Nimoy did a pretty good job.
Well, and Nimoy was all of a sudden making a name for himself as a director. Three Men and a Baby was huge.
Right.
So, you know, it was a surprise to see it go to Shatner, because you're like, well, what has he done?
Right. And, you know, he took it really seriously, and he tried to develop a story about God and, you know, the starship going to find God and destroying God or having a conversation with God. It was about religion. It got really heavy, which the studio wanted to kind of pull away from. But he was very hands-on. Whether they were good ideas or not, he did a lot to develop the story and to get that fifth one, you know, moving along. We all know how it turned out. We all know how it looks. We all know its faults.
What do you think? I'm fascinated by it because there's some good in it, but there's also some like, whoa.
Well, my problem, I guarantee what went on from possibly studio execs, but maybe just Shatner or the producers. I don't know. They kept looking back at this big, giant hit, which was Star Trek IV, biggest of the Star Trek films so far. We want to keep this franchise going. We've got to bring in a lot of humor. And it was oversaturated with humor. There were a lot of goofy scenes, and suddenly characters are acting really goofy between each other. It's kind of funny here and there, but there are a couple times where Shatner, you know, acts so goofy with Spock, you're just like, what is he doing?
Yeah, I think the thing that a lot of people gravitated towards was the row, row your boat scene.
Row your boat, talking about farting when you're eating beans.
And there was, of course, that scene, and this was the one that always sticks in my mind in the trailer, of Scotty, you know, turning around and bonking his head and falling down.
Right, because he knows...
Which didn't seem charismatic. Like, it didn't seem right for the Star Trek.
No, it just seemed like there were some sight gags and some jokes, and that's where they're going with this. I mean, Sulu and Chekhov get lost in the beginning, and they
the snowstorm
don't have
thing.
The guts to tell anybody where they are. Oh, we're snowed in. We can't see the terrible snowstorm. And then Chekhov starts blowing wind onto the thing to make it seem like there's a snowstorm. And then you heard it checks the weather and says, oh, it looks like clear skies. I mean, it's just the worst gags you could think of. Shatner gives some bad... I mean, you talk about casual outfits. He's wearing like a Starfleet jacket with like a sweatshirt that says, go climb a rock on his chest. Like... This is how see, and that's the other thing is Shatner goes, well, I'm going to do this. This is what I want to do. I love going mountain climbing. I love horses. We've got to have horses in here.
Yeah, that was obvious.
I mean, it's just so they write something in there, you know, whatever. The God thing kind of came into it, but and it's a mess. I mean, it's just, you know, from Uhura's fan dance to
thanks for that
to the big fat Klingon. You know, that just burps his way through his scenes to the Galileo trying to land in the Enterprise and just bouncing around like balsa wood. You know, it's got so much bad going on. But I'll give it this. There's a few things. It's got its moments. And one in particular is when the Leo Biscaglia of space, what's his name? Sarek or whatever. Sarek? Sauron? Enron? What's his name?
Lawrence Luckenbill's character?
Luckenbill's
character.
He does this bit where he's gonna reach out to...
Cybok.
He's going to reach out to Spock and to Kirk and to McCoy and have them face their biggest fear or their deep, dark secret or something heavy they carry around with them, deal with it and move on, sort of thing. And they do Spock, and it's like he goes, he can see the memory of his mother having him and the father immediately being disappointed at how human the baby looks and shaking his head like, you know, so from the time he was a baby, he was a disappointment to his father and he has to fucking see that, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But then they go to McCoy, and it to me is the single greatest piece of acting that DeForest Kelly ever did in his career. And they bring him to his father's deathbed. His father's going to die, and it's this horrible disease there was no cure for. And he begged his son to let him go. And so he committed euthanasia to save his father from the suffering. And then, you know, 6 months later, they found a cure for what his father was going through. And watch that scene again. McCoy is absolutely... I mean, DeForest Kelly is just outstanding in that scene. Like, he was, again, sometimes you see from these guys, they're much better actors than they're allowed to do sometimes. You know, all three of them on the original show, but McCoy was always great on the show. He did some great stuff. But there's some good stuff you can find in Five here and there.
I would agree with you on those scenes, those sequences with Cybok, but you're right, there's the tone of the film doesn't know exactly what it wants to be. And I find that the whole God subtext is just kind of quickly wrapped up.
Yeah.
I know they changed the ending of the film.
Yes.
But it doesn't really kind of flow right.
Yeah.
You don't quite know what they're trying to go for here as a result.
Yeah. So then we get, you know, a fond farewell wrap up, which is The Undiscovered Country. It was very...
Well, before we go to that, we should discuss that we did get merchandise for Star Trek V.
We did, that's right. We did get some merchandise.
We got we got the marshmallow dispenser, which I think was a craft mail away item.
Craft mail away.
Yeah, I know a lot of collectors who, you know, bought thousands of marshmallows to buy this valuable collectible that you can probably get for $10 on eBay now.
We got those funky galoob, non-posable, larger figures, statue figures.
What the heck were those?
I have no idea.
Now, Galoob had the Next Generation license.
Yes.
And I think... If you know licensing, I've had to do this where you want one license, and then the company goes, okay, you take this and this, you know. It happens, and I bet you that's exactly what happened to Galoob. They wanted the Next Generation, and they said, well, we've also got Star Trek V coming out. It's a big deal, so they took that as well. But they kind of went nowhere with it. Made these kind of nicely sculpted statue figures.
You kind of think they would have gone, you know, okay, you're doing your thing for Next Generation. Let's do something similar.
Yeah.
Along the same size.
But they were wise because the film bombed. Like, well, it didn't bomb, but it was a bit of a disappointment. And I don't think kids would have wanted figures of the characters, especially not in their classic look. Like, I think Kirk's all in black, isn't he?
Well, no. They're all, like, in their weird... Like, they've come back from camping, and now they're in their weird sort of... Kirk's in, like, a cream-colored sweatsuit, and Spock is in that white turtleneck, you know, and Bones is in a casual thing. They're not even in a uniform.
Yeah.
They've each got a different outfit, basically.
It was a very strange idea there. I'm not sure what they were going for. But
I know there's a lot of, you know, Lawrence Luckinbill collectors out there. You know, even this figure was pushing it.
And the Klingon villain is the last figure in the series.
Yeah.
And they're strangely posed, and they were limited edition, that's right. But they're mostly oddities, I find.
Yeah, they were just an odd thing that nobody bought. They were kind of expensive, and they were a strange size and a strange...
Did you ever see them at retail?
I did.
You did? Okay, I only saw them in a magazine.
I think
McCoy is the only one in a uniform, by the way.
I think I saw them at like a Suncoast Pictures kind of place.
Oh yeah,
that would have been where I saw them. So they got a bit of merchandise. They also got the Ertl, Bird of Prey and Enterprise diecast. They re-released those in Star Trek V packaging. Those came out, and then we roll into the fond farewell, which is the Undiscovered Country, which is not only Nicholas Meyer came back to help out with Star Trek IV, and he comes back to direct and help out with Star Trek VI, and consequently, the ones he worked on, 2, 4, and 6, are the strongest, and there's no coincidence that it had to do with him.
So, first teaser poster I have ever seen is for Star Trek VI. It is a picture of a movie theater seat with a seatbelt, and it says something like "Strap yourselves in, Star Trek VI."
Wow.
Yeah, I remember thinking, you got to be kidding me.
I've never seen that poster, thank God. I remember the trailer being really good. The trailer was great. The trailer was like the Enterprise slowly sort of passed in front of the screen, and images of television and film adventures, passed over the face of the ship, while Christopher Plummer narrated and said, for 25 years we have followed their voyages and listened to their hearts and shed their tears and all this stuff. Now come with us for one final voyage, to the undiscovered country or something.
Now, this film was a big disappointment. It got spectacular reviews, but I think the thing that was hurting it was pop culture at the time, The Simpsons, In Living Color, they all kind of poked fun at the cast's age.
Yeah.
And it was a big joke to kind of say, they got walkers, they've left the left turn signal on the Enterprise.
Yeah.
Which I still think is funny, but it I think it really hurt the film. And then you've got this next generation cast, so it makes... Even though I'm much more fond of the original series, it made the old show look dated, I guess.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah,
which is a real shame because that's better than any film that came after it.
Well, it's a shame too because it's a shame too because by virtue of just certain character, they didn't age terrifically. Like if I look at Nimoy looks kind of the same from 2 to 4 to 6. He's aged here and there, but he still looks pretty good. He looks not that different than he did in Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan. But Shatner, from Star Trek 3 to Star Trek 6, he's put on like 40 pounds.
Yeah,
I'm not going to be, but if you're the lead hero, and you don't want people going, oh, we got to take these guys seriously, then your lead guy needs to be a little more trim or fit because the jokes are going to start to fly fast and furious. And by that point, he just sort of had given up and, he had a tummy. And also, probably in the history of the motion pictures, and I thought the rug he had in motion picture was bad.
What are you saying?
The rug he had in Undiscovered Country is terrible.
Yeah, he got a real House of Masters look in the 80s.
Ooh, it just was all over the place. Just bad.
Yeah.
But it's a great script. There's some great drama in it, some great action. It's fun. It's got some decent comedy in it. You get to see a great scene between Spock and Kim Cattrall, who he sort of takes in as his protege, and... when she pulls a fast one, he is so disappointed. It's about the closest you see to pissed off rage in his face when he comes up to her, when he comes out here to give her the mind meld.
Yeah.
He is good and pissed. Just the different locations, they managed to get some different locations going on, and Sulu got his own ship and
Captain Sulu, I was going to mention that. That was really a cool thing. And I just watched, I think it's on Netflix, the Being Takei documentary.
Yeah, it's fun.
It's fun. I wish it was less of a reality show and more about his life.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, right. But it was a good one, and he does mention in that he wanted less lines just to be Captain Sulu.
Yeah, well, he'd been at it for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, as far as any of the, you know, Next Generation and Deep Space Nine and, you know, Enterprise and Voyager and all that stuff, whatever, it's just never got into it. I tried, but was really never my bag. I went to I watched, you know, Next Generation here and there, went to the movies, tried to just fake my way through storylines or in jokes or whatever, and hated Generations, absolutely hated it. Thought the one with the Borg was pretty good, but, you know, that's not saying much. And then the rest, I couldn't tell you who did what.
I never was I went to college in the early 90s, and that show was on ad nauseum,
yeah.
Next Generation. So I've probably seen every one. No offense to those that like it, because there's a lot of you. But it's something they boiled out of it is what I like about the original Star Trek. And I can't quite put my finger on what they did. But, I have some complaints, and I don't think anyone wants to hear them. But,
oh, let's hear them.
Very well. I've prepared a list. You know, I just find it a little sterile, I guess.
Okay.
You know, the whole ship looks like, not that the aesthetic bothers me so much, but it looks like they're all just traveling around in a dentist office. Nobody's as real. Like, I know that the original show, the characters are a bit of archetypes, but they don't get along. You know, at times you've got this kind of the same way I like the Fantastic Four. You know, McCoy and Spock bicker all the time behind Kirk, and that's sort of gone in the Next Generation. They're all kind of the get along gang, so to speak. And there's also just not the defined personalities. The most defined personality on the ship is probably Captain Picard and Data.
Well, I think they desperately tried to make Picard, Data, and what's his butt?
Yeah, exactly. What's his butt?
What's his name?
You know what? You're saying everything right now. You don't remember the character's name.
You know, Riker.
Yeah.
They were trying to make Riker and Riker and Data. And Data and Picard, the three of them. They were trying to recapture, especially with Data. Data was just such an obvious, you know, I'm a Vulcan because I don't.
Well, he was more Pinocchio, though.
Yeah, so he was more Pinocchio, of course.
Yeah.
And he's very quickly like, you're trying to deal with Spock, but, you know, you're never going to get Spock back because you don't have Spock. This is it for Spock. You know, you're pretending. But I'll tell you what. Here's what we'll do. We'll wrap it up this way, because I feel like we can give our reasons why we're not so chuffed with the new generation movies and slide right into the new films and what we like about them and why we like them and where we think they're going to go.
Sure.
We could do that as a third part, actually.
Yeah, that'd be fun, actually. And maybe the third one will be out when we get to it.
Well, but if not, you know, we can do it like in the next 6 months and talk about the merchandise and the toys that did come out for this and some of the Japanese stuff that's coming out and mm-hmm. the return of the utility belt and things like that. So maybe we should spend a little more time on, you know, the offshoot shows we don't really care about. Talk about those, what we think the drawbacks are, why we're not digging them, and why we were so excited by 2009's new Star Trek.
Yeah, that would be actually a great topic. So maybe we should talk about the TV. And, you know, we can intersplice that with the 90s Star Trek explosion.
Yes.
Like, it was crazy.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and, you know, the fact that I wore my Starfleet uniform to work every day.
No.
Well, one day, they fired me.
You didn't.
I don't own a Starfleet uniform.
Oh, God. I don't know. It could have been a weird thing that happened to you.
No.
That you don't remember.
Well, I would remember.
I don't know. Yeah. Something could have happened. You're on a jury. You're on a jury duty.
We could also talk about that film.
Yeah. Trekkies?
Yes. Love
yes,
it.
Yes. I know some of the folks behind that.
All right. So
we're going to bottle a Romulan ale, and we'll pick it up for part three.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. So see you in 30 days, folks.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Take care. Bye.